Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The murder of 2.5-year-old Bella Bond has left us all wondering, how does a tragedy like this happen? A small, defenseless child apparently beaten to death and thrown away like so much garbage.
It's the latest case that puts a spotlight on the Department of Children and Families, which has been involved with the girl's family as recently as 2013. But it also raises the question, where was Bella's extended family in all of this? And where were her neighbors who saw troubling evidence of neglect and of her mother's drug-addicted life?
In his column for the Boston Globe, Kevin Cullen asks, how hard could it have been to make an anonymous call? And Kevin Cullen joins us now. Kevin Cullen, always good to have you. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Anthony.
Also with us is Susan Elson. She's a child advocate and staff attorney at the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute, which focuses on children and family welfare issues. And Susan Elson, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. Why wasn't more done to protect Bella Bond? Was this just the latest breakdown of DCF, the state child welfare agency, or was it a more profound failing of family members and neighbors? Where does government responsibility end and the community's responsibility begin? Where do they intersect? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and at Radio Boston. Kevin Cullen, I was very moved, as I know a lot of readers were, by your column. But sum up what about this case you find most shocking.
It's a combination. I mean, we don't know the extent, Anthony, of DCF's involvement or lack of involvement. I think that will come later. But I think we do know that both Bella's extended family and the people that lived in the apartment building on Maxwell Street in Dorchester obviously knew her, and somehow she just fell off their radar, and that when she disappeared suddenly in the late spring, no one in that building seemed to think that something untoward had happened. No one seemed to see all the photos that the state police had created digitally to show, which I thought was a striking resemblance of the baby Doe recreation and what we know now Bella looked like. No one seemed to put that two and two together.
Yeah. And one of the things you mention in your column, and we read about it in the papers, is some of the neighbors and others suggest that they just didn't think it was their business to get involved with this. And I know in retrospect, it's sort of easy to say, oh, my God, how could you think that? But obviously they should have.
Yeah, and like I said, it's so easy to judge people in those situations. And I was trying to think of my own, what would I have done if one of my neighbor's kids suddenly just disappeared and I didn't see it, especially a younger kid? I think I would say something, just out of sheer curiosity.
Yeah.
But, I talked to some of the neighbors, and there are two things that they almost all said in separate, not together, but in separate conversations, is that they were frightened by the people, the men, this stream of men that used to go to Rochelle Bond's apartment, and that she herself, they described her as appearing to be under the influence of drugs regularly, and that they just were afraid of these people, and they didn't want anything to do with them. And this idea that if they blow the whistle on somebody, there'd be some kind of retaliation. So it's this horrible mix of apathy and fear that combined to feel this little girl. And,
sure.
It's easy to beat up the people in the building. I realize that, and I kind of resist doing it, but you just shake your head and understand and say, because a lot of some of the people in that building have kids of their own, but the next door neighbor was talking to us holding a child that, was probably half the age of Bella. And she said she noticed that, I used to hear Bella in her bedroom was right against my wall. I would hear all of it. And then all of a sudden it stopped.
It stopped and no call was made. Kevin Cullen, stand by. I want to bring Susan Elson into this conversation. And Susan, we sort of raised the question where the government's responsibility ends and the communities begin. But before we talk about DCF, whether DCF should have, could have done more, I'd love you to chime into sort of what Kevin's been talking about, just this idea, because, and I want Meghna in on this conversation too, because as a staff, we were talking a lot about this morning, and one of the points that was raised is, it is easy to second guess and wonder why no one made the call. At the same time, we live in a society that seems to I don't know, be reluctant to do so and to embrace privacy and to not want to get in other people's business. And obviously, when something like this happens, you second guess that impulse. But what's your take, Susan, about where we are?
Sure. Well, as policy advocates, we really try to look at what can be done better. And so one important point, I think, is that while it's important to shine the spotlight on DCF, it's also very important to pull that light back some and cast it on a wider circle of both state agencies, community institutions, and community members who all have responsibilities for keeping children safe. So I want to really add in here the state agencies that serve children and families, and also community institutions that interact with children often on a daily basis, such as schools, child care centers, medical providers, religious institutions.
So it sounds like you're talking about a need for these agencies to somehow coordinate better and really get a view of the big picture in a way that might not, that did not obviously happen in this, in this child's.
So how
do we do that?
So it's harder, obviously, with a child under five who's not out in the community and under the eyes of the community. And that was likely the case with Bella. But in general, what we see is the need for a comprehensive plan. And there are five elements of that that we consider particularly important to bring in this range of actors, all of whom share responsibility for child safety. So I can give you a sense of what the elements of such a plan would be. One is to create an interagency task force of all the child-serving agencies that would be charged with identifying the gaps in prevention services to prevent abuse and neglect in the first place, even before it gets to DCF. And then also create local counterparts to that interagency task force, bringing together local community members who all have different perspectives on a child, who can come together and maybe put together a larger picture of what's happening with a child, something that DCF identified didn't happen in the case of Jake Loisel, the Hardwick 7-year-old boy who's currently in a coma. We also really recommend implementing children's impact statements, like environmental impact statements, requiring an assessment of how service cuts would affect the rate of child abuse and neglect. It's really key. We've seen this in all the cases, the recent child tragedies and in the reports, to collect, examine, and share data to assess what we're doing well and where kids are falling through the gaps.
Susan, I want to hear more specifically about what you propose in terms of policy. I'd also like you to sort of speak to the point that Kevin Cullen raised, because in a way, I don't know, is there something that DCF or these other child welfare, other agencies that have child welfare in their mission can somehow improve relationships with the community so that perhaps members of the community would respond more reflexively when something like this is going on?
That's a great question, and it's so important. It's very hard to get into the minds of the individual neighbors and understand why exactly they didn't report, why family members didn't. But, you know, they did identify fear. But your point is, what would make it more natural for them to go to authorities? And I think it's an important question, especially with low-income people who don't necessarily always have easy interactions with government authorities. The question is, for me, a really important question is, what would make people more likely to go to DCF to report concerns about child safety?
Because might there be a concern that DCF does one thing, and that is they sort of intervene and maybe too quickly take a child away from a parent? I mean, might that be a concern
exactly.
that would cause someone to hesitate to reach out?
Exactly. So DCF, I don't think, is seen as a warm and friendly community institution, and that's for a number of reasons. And a big reason is because DCF isn't able often enough to provide the services that struggling families need to keep their kids safe at home, even though that really is their mandate when a child is at risk, to first assess whether they can keep a child safe at home and with services, and only then, if they can't, then remove the child. So, but DCF isn't necessarily perceived as an agency that provides services, that helps families who themselves are concerned and reaching out for help. So I think those are areas that could definitely be improved with increased funding for services, with more voluntary services to families who seek them out. Mm. And, yeah.
No, go ahead. I wanted to bring Kevin back in. Kevin, we've got a bunch of callers who want to get in on this conversation, but I'm wondering if listening to Susan Elson's points and sort of policy prescriptions, and in particular this idea of getting the word out somehow that convincing people to reach out to DCF, or what DCF needs to do to convince people to reach out to them.
Yeah, I think you also have to remember that the people that lived in Bella's orbit, you know, might have really been concerned about bringing government into their own houses.
Right. Yeah.
But then again, as I said, what was to prevent anybody from making an anonymous call?
Yeah.
But I think there really is, because call DCF on a neighbor, you might have this in the back of your mind. What if DCF comes into my house and starts questioning me the way I raise my kids? Or
right.
So that, there is a lot of fear out there. There's fear and mistrust, but there's, I think we have to keep getting back to the word apathy.
Yeah.
Because I think, and that, like I said, I talked to Bella's father, Joe Amoroso, and he was saying that him and his mother had called DCF in 2012 and 2013. But I said to him, Joe, what have you done the last 2 years for your daughter? You never met your daughter. So, those are questions that beg to be answered. But, Bella just was in between. As I said, that it seemed like strangers cared more about her than people who knew her.
You also turned a pretty powerful phrase in your piece that, these were people caught in the chaotic vortex of addiction and dysfunction and poverty. And so it was almost inevitable that the person most endangered was a child in their care.
Yeah.
And, that gets to a whole host of issues that society, is struggling to deal with, including the addiction crisis and so on and so forth.
Yep. I also said that Bella had more names than people looking after her.
Mm.
That second name, Neva, was actually heaven spelled backwards, which... Mm. It's beyond ironic.
Oh, boy. Well, listeners, we'd like to get your involvement in this conversation. What could have happened? What should have happened? Where did society, DCF, neighbors, family fail Bella? 800-423-8255. Let's go to Eileen. She's calling from Watertown. Hi, Eileen. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for covering this important issue. So I just wanted to respond to something I heard a little while ago about, maybe somebody could have picked up the phone and made a call. And a while back, I was unhappily witness to what I thought were clear signs of child abuse and neglect in some very small children who lived right across from me. And I did call Child Welfare Services, and I made the call anonymously, and I gave them the information that I thought would help these children, but I was told that they couldn't do anything unless I saw the abuse myself, like direct somebody hitting a child.
Mm.
Very discouraging.
Yes, Eileen, that is indeed. Susan Elson, what is the standard there? I mean, so if we did call DCF because we suspected that a neighbor was doing something terrible to a child, how does it work? How should it work?
Well, the standard is really whether there's reasonable cause to believe that a child has been abused or at risk of abuse. So that standard wouldn't rule out a call like that. So I guess I'd have to question whether that was an accurate response or a well-informed response to the call. And that's a concern that's been raised in a number of these cases, whether the intake screening is appropriate.
All right. Eileen, thanks for that call. Let's go to another caller. Judy is calling from Wellesley. Judy, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks. This is a horrendous tragedy, and I can't imagine anybody can think that it's anything but a horrendous tragedy. And it, identifies the need for additional services for adults with addiction, for children who are at risk, and so forth and so on. But then, on the other hand, when I hear political debates and political campaigning, the biggest thing that people talk about is, oh, I'm going to lower your taxes, let's reduce taxes, let's reduce taxes. So I don't know how a reasonable person can think, let's spend less money and have better services. It just isn't going to happen, and it's so obvious that better services need to be available to people.
Mm. Well, Judy, I appreciate the point, and Susan, I want to come to you on Judy's point, because it seems like, I mean, Judy makes a good point. Obviously, good social services cost money, and they cost real money, but there are this seems to be a case where it might well have been about lack of funds, but it also seemed to be about a lack of ability for people who were in a position to know to connect the dots. I mean, it seems like about much more than money, I guess I'm asking.
Well, money is an element, and yeah. DCF has to be more robustly funded than it mm-hmm. is. And that has to be in conjunction with a comprehensive plan that we stick to. It's going to need to be funded, and we're going to need to stick to it even as these tragedies occur. We can't go for the quick fix. So there's the funding, there's the planning, there's the stick-to-it-ness. I agree with Judy's point. You know, one of the things to really pay attention to is that our funding for services to keep kids safe at home is extremely low in relation to what we pay for foster care.
Mm. Hey, can I come in on that too?
Oh yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
I agree. Susan is absolutely right. The DCF is just underfunded. The social workers underappreciated, overworked. You can't keep the tabs necessary on these vulnerable kids with what we have in place. I'd also argue that, you know, by the time it gets to DCF, by the nature, it's too late. These kids are caught up in this horrible vortex. And the reality is we pay lip service to mental health and addiction services. In this state, this so-called most progressive state in the union, in the last, up until very recently, all the beds that we had, and there weren't many of them, were being closed. We were losing beds every year for addiction. And the legislature just last year put a little more money into that in mental health care. But like the MBTA and the trains that don't run in the snow, this is a problem that goes back decades. Mm. And we have never taken it seriously. And until we do, you're still setting up kids who were born to people with mental illness, to people with, you know, horrible drug addictions, and a kid that's in that situation is by definition vulnerable and in danger.
Over the weekend, Governor Charlie Baker says that DCF would move swiftly to implement a series of recommendations made after the 7-year-old child from Hardwick was allegedly starved and beaten into a coma by his father. They include updating the agent's risk assessment and intake systems. Susan, can you explain what that means? And is that an important part of the fix that has to happen?
There's clearly a fix that has to come within DCF. Internal policies have not been updated. Guidance hasn't been updated. I would ask whether DCF has the adequate staffing to implement some of the guidance that they propose to write. But there's also the need to bring in the other state agencies that provide substance abuse services, mental health services, domestic violence services, homelessness services, mm-hmm. because we know those are the issues that drive children and families into the child welfare system. And those services are prevent abuse and neglect before it happens, and they have to come from other agencies. DCF can't do it alone. Mm. So let's harness the substance abuse strategies that we're developing now and use them as abuse and neglect prevention strategies.
So I take your point that DCF can't do this on its own, but disabuse me or someone who might look at this with the benefit of hindsight and learn that Bella's mother, Rochelle Bond, lost custody of her two older children. DCF was involved twice with her family as recently as 2013. Rochelle Bond has a lengthy criminal record dating back to 1999. Her boyfriend, Michael McCarthy, the alleged killer, also had a criminal record. And yet somehow they couldn't connect the dots.
And that, I can't fully disabuse you of that because that is a question and it has to be investigated. What I'm not going to do is jump in and draw conclusions before I see DCF's report.
Sure. I got it. Let's go to Jennifer, who's calling from Cambridge. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a parent in a family. My husband and I have two young children. We live in a low to middle income affordable housing unit in Cambridge. That's absolutely lovely, and it's a very close-knit, physically it's a close-knit community. Culturally, we're really diverse, and we get along the best we can. My example is I'm very friendly with my next-door neighbor, and they have a few children of different ages in there, and somebody had a baby. And I'm friendly with them, but I haven't seen them. I hear the baby crying, and I'm really curious who the baby is. It's not really my business to knock on the door and go, like, whose baby is that? And congratulations. My point is that I think, sadly, we overestimate what DCF can do. Unfortunately, no disrespect to my neighbor, but, like, any jerk can have a baby, and there's no requirements in that. It's easier to have a baby than it is to get a fishing license in this state, and I wish there was a way to prevent abuse before it happens, but I don't think it's possible.
Jennifer from Cambridge, Susan, there's Jennifer from Cambridge expressing some pessimism, no way to prevent abuse. What would you say to her?
I don't think there's any way to eliminate abuse, but mm-hmm. I think we can cut down on the number of times it happens by addressing the issues that we know cause abuse and neglect. And, and as I mentioned, there are four big ones. And, you know, there are others. I think Jennifer also mentioned living in a close-knit community. I mean, that is another key thing because we know that children are nurtured by families and by their communities. And so to the extent that we can build in a sense of community, I think we can do better to keep children safe.
Kevin, you know, speaking of responsibility, about saying something, I wanted to just, I'm sort of going to turn this in another direction just briefly for the final minute or so, but say something about the dogged police investigation in this case. You noted in your piece that Suffolk County Dan Connolly and state police investigators really took this case personally.
Yeah, and the Winthrop detectives, too, and they really did because, you know, we didn't know who Bella was, but, you know, Deanne Herman, and who was the lead investigator, a state trooper, and when he stood there with his other colleagues, that when they found the body, they just vowed they were gonna, you know, find out who this girl is, and they wanted her to be claimed, and they wanted her to have a proper burial. And I remember talking to one of the sergeants from the state police about this, who worked very closely with Dan. They would talk among themselves that what they hoped for is that this was a child who had some kind of illness or some kind of affliction, a disease or something, and just died of natural causes, and had vulnerable parents or a parent who just panicked and dumped the body. And then last week, when they realized, it was very hard on them. But as I said, these cops looked at Bella as, it could be their daughter, it could be their niece, it could be their neighbor's kid.
Yep.
And that really drove them. And I think, like I said, it's unfortunate that there were these strangers who never met Bella who cared more about her than the people who did meet her, who did know her.
Hmm. I want to try and get one more call in before we have to wrap up. Susan is calling from Needham. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, I just, I am so outraged, even at the tone of the conversation on this show, that people are sort of calmly talking about policies and task forces. For the love of God, these children are dying. You're talking about social workers that are overworked, who, by the way, aren't even social workers, they're caseworkers. And they are, our children in our community, who we are all responsible for, are dying. And every time this happens, we sit down and talk about task forces and policies. And someone needs to stand up on the freaking table and pound their chest and say, it ends now. And now, not to talk about it and talk about it and masticate on it until we're blue in the face. This is unbelievable that in a civilized society, our children are dying in front of our eyes, and all we do is talk about policy. It is so unacceptable. people.
Susan, we hear your passion. We appreciate it. And I can assure you that everyone on this staff feels an enormous sense of outrage, even helplessness about what's going on. But the fact that we're talking calmly about it doesn't necessarily mean we don't feel this to the core of our soul, how important it is. But Susan Nelson, a final word, responding to Susan, our caller.
Yeah, thank you, Susan. I mean, it's your passion and your sense of outrage, which I share, which drives me to devote my life to this work. And yes, we talk about policy because we need to know what to do. We can't sit there and blame people. We can't go for the quick fixes. We need to find a way of changing things. That's why we work so hard to develop policies that are going to avert these situations in the future. So I share your passion, and we work hard to find solutions.
And so we'll end it there on Susan's passion. Susan Nelson, staff attorney at the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute. She focuses on children and family welfare issues. Susan Nelson, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And Kevin Cullen, he's a columnist for the Boston Globe. You can find a link to his most recent column on Bella Bond at RadioBoston.org. Kevin Cullen, thanks as always. Always a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Anthony.
Stay with us. There's a lot more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.